We hope you enjoy this recording of a live broadcast brought to you via the ETIM Network, the online, live, interactive division of Torah in Motion. For more learning opportunities, please visit www.torahinmotion.org.
Okay, it's 9 o'clock.
I think we can start, and I just want to welcome back all our friends who we haven't seen for a little bit, and to our next series. I think this is at least our fifth series in Mark's ongoing, you know, talks on Gadol Yisrael, on movers and shakers and architects, great rabbinic leaders, and it's really a pleasure having him and learning from him. And we want to thank him again, but just to sort of officially thank him as we kick off the new series for the stimulating the talks and discussion he causes, and it's really a pleasure. And we're gonna welcome him to Toronto live this weekend for the conference in honor of the 200th birthday of Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. So those who live in Toronto, we expect to see you at B'nai Torah. And without further ado, it's a pleasure to start our new series on great rabbinic leaders.
Okay, thank you, Rabbi Kelman. Let me just say a few words before we begin. We've had a few different types of series, some focusing on great rabbinic leaders, some focusing on specifically modern Orthodox leaders. An early email called this modern Orthodox figures or architects of modern Orthodoxy. That only applies perhaps to two of the figures, Rabbi Nissim and Rabbi Chaim Hirschenson. The others, Ratzvi Pesach Frank and Rosh Shlomo Messas, I think we'd have to categorize them just as general Gedolei Yisrael, but we'll deal with both of them. Just a few technical things for those, I see some names I don't recognize. For those who haven't been here before, basically I speak for about an hour, and then we'll have comments and questions. Well, as we go along, you can type in comments at the bottom and send it to me. You can play around with the pictures. You can enlarge my picture or make it smaller if you want. You can stack the pictures. It's really a very good technological system. Occasionally, it seems that's once every, I guess, a semester, once every 8 classes, something goes wrong. You know, it's still technology in its infancy. If you lose sound, sometimes it's your problem. You'll send an email. I mean, you can contact by just send something at the bottom or send directly to the tech support. It's usually just an individual computer. If you're wireless, it often is a problem. But occasionally we froze. One time last semester, I just went blank. And if that happens, if you lose me, just stay there. It'll take me about 2 minutes. I have to log on again and get going, so I'm not going anywhere if you lose me, but 95% of the time everything goes along beautifully. And if you are having some problem, if I do break up, it's probably the wireless, so if you can be attached, that's even better. As Rabbi Kelman said, we've been doing this now 5 or 6, I can't keep track yet, about 50 previous classes, and it's a continuing series. I will begin, before I get right into Rav Chaim Hirschenson, I'll begin by responding to some comments, some things, I don't know if I'll get to all of them today, I'll split them up, but because people send me comments, I wasn't able to get to all of them last time, and also we have a number of people who listen online, and they send me things, and some of the things they send me I think are relevant and interesting to share with the class. So without further ado, let us begin. And as I said, I just want to begin by calling your attention to a few things which are really relevant to things we've done in the past. The first is that this coming Sunday you have the 13th New York Sephardic Film Festival, sponsored by Yeshiva University and the American Sephardic Federation. It's showing the movie, Two Legacies, by Einat Kapach, or Kapach. Let me read you just how it's described. You'll recall that 2 semesters ago we dealt with Kapach. A year before his death, Yosef Kapach gave his granddaughter Einat papers containing a secret he had guarded for decades, a theological dispute between the two schools of Yemenite Jewry and his persecution by the Sana Jewish community. Einat goes on a journey to unravel his struggles and the path that led him to become a world-renowned Jewish philosopher. And that, of course, she's referring to, or the ad here is referring to the dispute over Kabbalah. We spoke a great deal about it, and I will be in Toronto, but those who are in New York, you can, it's 8 p.m. And then I contacted her earlier in the week, and she told me it's going to be on DVD. That'll be the second DVD about Rav Kafach's life and about the persecution. He alludes to it in places. For example, Rav Kafach's father was put in jail by the opponents of the Dardaim, and he was beaten in jail, and he died from his beating. So the opponents, the Kabbalistic segment of Yemenite Jewry was responsible, at least a portion of it, for not just Masira, but for his father's death. So during his lifetime, as I mentioned, Rav Kafach did not want to speak about this. He didn't want controversy. But now I understand, I read some of the reviews of the movie, which has already appeared in Israel at a film festival. He wanted this information to see the light after his death. A couple other things. Rabbi Nataf, some of you might know Rabbi Chaim Nataf from Montreal. Well, I guess he's a fan. He sent me something very interesting, which is relevant to things we discussed when we dealt with Rav Uziel, and we had a lot of discussions about this. If you recall, we dealt with traveling by train on Shabbos, if you buy the tickets ahead of time. And I told you the story about how Rav Soloveitchik was absolutely opposed to it for the Jews in Russia because of the conservative movement, where it would lead to. Well, and I mentioned that the Sephardic world, often they just decide these issues based on the halakha. They don't have to deal with what I call meta-halakha considerations, where it's going to lead to, etc. We spoke about the whole situation in the Hamptons with Rabbi Schneier's shul, what he wanted to do. Rabbi Nataf sent me that in Rav Avadya Yosef's new book, one of his new books, Chazon Avodya, here's an example of what they look like. Rav Avadya has put together he has about 10 of these volumes now. It's very similar to the books of his sons, Yalkut Yosef and the Halacha Brewer. In fact, I don't know why he needed to do this also, but you have the Halacha on top and the sources at the bottom. And this is what he says in the new book that just came out. I'll just translate it, that a tram or a trolley inside a city, and if the driver is not Jewish, and most of the passengers are not Jewish, and it stops automatically at every stop, even though it's forbidden to go on it on Shabbos because you can't carry the money or the card, if you paid ahead of time from Erev Shabbos, or the person who takes the ticket knows you, or let's say there's an Erev, I know it doesn't say that, but that's obvious, and they don't require you to show them anything, if it's for a mitzvah, for example, a doctor, or a moel who has to go far away, according to Jewish law, it is permissible, and if you can, you shouldn't make a public spectacle of it. The question is whether this would also include people far away from shul on Shabbos. He doesn't say, but presumably it would. But here's another example of how Rav Avadya, he's not afraid, he just says what he thinks the halacha is. What's the problem? It's no different than the Shabbos elevator, and he's not at all concerned with these meta halachic things. I thought that was quite interesting. And there's a couple more points, but I'll leave them to next class. The last one I just want to show you is, some of you asked me, I mentioned this book by Moshe Sherman, Orthodox Judaism in America, a biographical dictionary and source book. I mentioned Sherman because he's the one who wrote the dissertation on Bernard Illowy that we spent a good deal of time on last class. But this is a biographical dictionary with nice articles and sources on all the great Orthodox figures in America up until modern times, all the great rabbis. So it really is a... It's a vital source for those who are interested in the history of American Orthodoxy. It was always very expensive. It's one of these books that they charge, I don't know, like $100 for, but I was able to find it on AB Books last year. And so maybe you can find it, too, if you're interested. I don't know if he includes Canada. Let me take a quick look here. I'll just look at, let's say, Gedalia Felder. Yes, he includes Canada, too. So there you go. Okay. He is from Ottawa. Moshe Sherman's from Ottawa? Okay, well, that maybe explains it. Okay, we are now beginning with Rav Chaim Hirschenson, the first in our series for this semester. I don't know if we'll finish all of them this semester. We sometimes haven't because we get caught in tangents, and I like doing that, but we will begin with Rav Chaim Hirschenson, move on to Rav Nissim, following him, move on to Rav Tzipesach Frank, and conclude with Rav Sholem Messas. I think some of you probably are wondering, who is Rav Sholem Messas? Suffice to say that many of you have heard of all these minor Rosh Yeshiva and haven't heard of him. He was, until his death a few years ago, the second most important figure in the Sephardic rabbinic world after Rav Avadya Yosef, someone who is a major, major figure. And the fact that so few of us have heard of him shows, as I'll speak about, how Ashkenazic-centered we are. Okay. With Rav Chaim Hirschenson, let me show you a little picture of him. You can see a picture of him in the Encyclopedia Judaica, but here's also a picture of him. We come to a very fascinating figure, one who was well-known and controversial in his lifetime and never really disappeared completely from the scene, but for the most part he did. No one for the last 40 years really mentioned him, other than occasionally Rabbi Bleich in one of his books mentions him, but he really was a very insignificant figure. I cited him a few times in my book on the 13 Principles, yet he was incredibly original. Everything he wrote is full of stunning new insights. Now, those who knew about Hirschenson, and even those who know about him, fall into two camps, I think. Those who are happy that he was forgotten, and those who see his ideas, patiently mapped out in many works of halakha and Jewish thought, as providing the tools for a new, confident, modern orthodoxy. Now, I first discovered Rav Chaim Hirschenson when I was a student at Brandeis in the 1980s. Brandeis, for those who don't know, and by the way, when I was in Brandeis, it's not like Brandeis is today, in which I'm told they get like 60 guys for Minyan Sunday morning. We had a hard time getting a Minyan. In fact, there's Chuvos, published Chuvos, about the problem which I had, which I wrote to these Gedolim. What do you do? Was it better to daven by oneself or wait a little while longer till you get the Minyan? The problem is when the Minyan shows up, you'll have missed Zman Tefillah, the proper time for saying Shmon Esrei. Believe it or not, the Mishnah Berurah doesn't, or Aruch HaShulchan, none of them mention this. But although there always was a strong Orthodox component, someone is pressing down on the thing, and there's an amazing Jewish library there. Okay, someone is pressing down on the sound. Okay, there you go. If you want to say something later, then we can press down the sound, but if you lock it now, there's a lot of blowback, I think they call it. No, thank you. But they had an amazing library, and they've always had a very good Jewish studies department. So I discovered this Sefer. I just back from Israel for my year, and I never heard of it, and I started opening it up and looking through it and amazed at what I see there. In fact, it's come full circle almost, because here I'm holding in my hand Orthodoxy and Modernity. Can you see it here? I mean, someone's blocking my, I have to move someone's head out of the way. Orthodoxy and Modernity, Rav Chaim Hirschenson's Malki Bakodesh. I'm actually going to move someone's head up a little bit so I can see myself better. This is a Brandeis BA thesis written by Mark Herman. He's now studying for Smicha at YU, written a few years ago. From my discovering him, and I don't know anyone else who's reading the Malki Bakodesh, now you have a wonderful work of over 100 pages, and I'll get back to this in a little while. For the longest time, I thought that I was the only one interested in him. Yes, it's in English. He gave me a copy of it. I don't know if he wants it around, because it's really a quality work of scholarship. There's no question that right now he could take stuff out of that and publish it in journals. Certainly in journals like Hakira or others, Taramata Journal, but I think he wants to expand it perhaps into a doctoral dissertation, so he doesn't want all of his ideas to get out. But for a long time, I thought that I was the only one really interested in him, and yet in the last 20 years, there's been I won't say an explosion, but a great revival of interest in him. And he is undergoing something of a revival. We'll see soon why the religious Zionists are drawn to him. There have been scholarly articles on him just a couple months ago in this, some of you might know this journal, Conversations, published by Mark Angel's New Institute. There's an article in here by David Zohar, Rabbi Chaim Hirschenson, The Forgotten Sage Who Was Rediscovered. Now, this David Zohar, he's also the author of this book, Mechuyavot Yehudit V'Olam HaModerni, which is all about, let me tell you the English title, it's a whole book published a couple of years ago, Jewish Commitment in the Modern World, Rav Chaim Hirschenson and His Attitude Towards the Modern World. So you have a whole book on Rav Chaim Hirschenson. In addition, there have been a number of articles that have appeared recently in journals like Modern Judaism. I will say that although I thought no one was interested in him, it wasn't exactly the case, because prior to that, in the 1970s, Eliezer Schweid, who's a great scholar, Jewish philosophy, he's published something like 50 books, he published this book, Halacha v'Demokratia, English translation here, Democracy and Halacha. This is in English, published in 1994, but the Hebrew volume was published sometime earlier, 1978, so he had an interest, and he thought he was significant. And then Torah V'Avoda in the 1980s, the Torah V'Avoda people, 1988, that's the religious Zionist, there's a religious Zionist, the Kibbutz Adati, they came out with this little booklet, HaTorah V'Chaim, Torah and Life. Here you have Rav Chaim Hirschenson, which is excerpts of his writings on numerous themes. So there were always people who were interested in him. This book came out just 2 years ago. Malki Bakodesh. Malki Bakodesh is his volumes of responsa, which we'll speak about. A new edition, volume one. The problem I have with this book, and what I think is quite unfortunate, some of you probably disagree, I'm maybe a little more close-minded than you, but it was published by three people, three institutes, Bar Ilan, Hartman Institute, and Machon Schechter L'Madei Yadut, and the Conservative Yeshiva in Israel. Now, what's the problem with that? I mean, there's no problem per se in that the Conservative Yeshiva publishes all sorts of good stuff, and JTS publishes all sorts of scholarship. The problem in this case is, however, I think that this will enable people who don't like him to associate him with the conservatives and their understanding of halacha. Although, well, there's no question that the early conservative movement would have found a great deal to like in him, and there are similarities. But now to publish something coming out of the JTS, you know, when you think of who Rav Chaim Hirschenson is and you connect him to the seminary, it's then going to delegitimize him. That wasn't David Zohar, who edited this. That wasn't his purpose, but I think it was a result. Yet if you look at the Malki Bakodesh, yes, we'll see radical ideas, but you see correspondence with all the Gedolim, with Rav Kook, with Rav Pesach Frank, with many, many others. He was someone who was part and parcel of the rabbinic world, a member of the Agudas Rabbanim, and I'm afraid that such a book could have the unintended consequence of having people look at it and say, well, what do you expect? Look who's publishing his works. It's precisely because certain people in Israel, especially the seminary in Israel, which is much more halachic, David Galinkin, they're much more attached to Jewish law than the seminary in America, they see Rav Chaim Hirschenson as a model for halacha in modern times. And I don't think you need to be a conservative Jew. I think, all sorts of Orthodox Jews feel similarly, be that as it may. Yeah, yes, that is true. I have a whole list of tshuvot and other things attacking Hirschenson. Hirschenson was attacked by a number of people. He wrote a whole Yiddish pamphlet defending himself, but we will get to that. The Hartman Association, perhaps, but I don't know. It just rubbed me a little bit the wrong way, because precisely now, when people are beginning to look again at religious Zionism and everything, he is the person who could be a different model for Jewish law, and I would hate to see his legs cut off right from the beginning. Okay. By the way, if you want to see his books, many of them, including all the responsa, are found on HebrewBooks.org. So you can look at that. And in fact, I have PDFs, but now I see that they're available on HebrewBooks.org as well. His journal, Hamisterona, one of the first rabbinic journals, we'll speak about in a minute. But let's begin with the biography, as we always do. He was born in 1857 in Tzfat, Safed. His parents had come on Aliyah from Pinsk, as we spoke about with Ritzi Hirsch Kalischer. Anyone who comes on Aliyah in the mid-19th century is a real lover of Zion. His father Rav Yaakov Mordechai Hirschenson was, he was connected to Rav Chaim Hirschenson, to Rav Swedish Kalischer. He was a great lover of Zion. As we spoke about, most people came to die. Anyone who came to Israel in those days, or for the most part, they came to die. Rav Yaakov Mordechai Hirschenson, he came to live. He opens up the yeshiva in Tzfat. And Rav Chaim Hirschenson has the typical upbringing of anyone living there, going to yeshiva. But early on, he showed he does not have the typical personality. His father moves to Jerusalem in 1864, and while there, Rav Chaim Hirschenson, or at least a few years later, begins to study secular subjects. It wasn't so easy in Jerusalem to find it, but he was able to find it. And also to show views of the Chovei Tzion type of views. We don't have a political Zionist movement yet, but you still have a Chovei Tzion, and we spoke about how people were opposed to a Sirish Kalischer, especially people in the land of Israel. They thought that the old yeshiva, which was supported as a tzedakah, that if you start creating settlements, this will affect their support. He, however, Chaim Hirschenson, was firmly on the side of rebuilding the land of Israel. At this time, you have the creation of Hebrew language. Eliezer ben Yehuda has come on Aliyah, and he becomes the founder of a Safa Brura society, which is devoted to reviving Hebrew. In fact, when Eliezer ben Yehuda first comes to Israel, he dresses like a Hasidic or a Yerushalmi with a long coat. His wife wore a shadel. He did it for the sake of Hebrew. Later on, he saw he wasn't getting anywhere. He went back to his old ways, which was not religious. But Rav Chaim Hirschenson was very friendly and close to Eliezer ben Yehuda. Already with that, we see how different he is than the rest of the old Yishuv, because they avoided Eliezer ben Yehuda like the plague. They regarded him as a heretic. In fact, Chaim Hirschenson was one of the founders, together with ben Yehuda, of the Safa Brura Society. Yes, you mentioned his memoir, Chaim Landerer, his daughter's memoir, so I'll bring it over here right now. Memoirs of Childhood, I'll speak about this in a few minutes when I talk about the children of Rav Chaim Hirschenson, because his children are fascinating. Eliezer ben Yehuda, in the late 19th century, was the first Hebrew-speaking household. That is, his children were the first children brought up speaking Hebrew. Chaim Hirschenson's children were the second children in history, that is, at least in modern history, brought up speaking Hebrew. And let me tell you about this story. Incidentally, you should know, we have people in America who were brought up years ago, Hebrew-speaking households. Obviously not that far back, but since some of you I know have a connection to the seminary, I'll tell you that Gerson Cohen was brought up in a Hebrew-speaking household. Now, of course, it wasn't Hebrew-speaking like we speak Hebrew today. You'd say S, and, it was Ashkenazic Hebrew. But Gerson Cohen was brought up in a Hebrew-speaking household. Now, if you read Eliezer ben Yehuda's life story, it's really fascinating. He insists, first of all, he brings his wife and children to Israel, and he insists that they only speak Hebrew. The problem was that his wife didn't know any Hebrew, and he wouldn't talk to her unless she spoke in Hebrew, so he tried to teach her Hebrew. His children had a very difficult development. We know, we have memoir literature discussing this, at age 3 and 4, they were not speaking properly. Now, this could have, I believe, all sorts of psychological implications and could affect the child for life. One of his colleagues said to Ben Yehuda that your children, most things don't have words in modern Hebrew. Eliezer ben Yehuda had to invent them. The typical things that we speak about during the day, they all had to be invented, the words for them. So the children couldn't communicate properly, and one of his colleagues said to him that this could have a real impact on your children negatively. And he replied, that's possible, but Hebrew is worth it. And he's willing to sacrifice his children to make it a living language. And in 1889, he founds the Safa Brura Society. Now, a book just came out by a guy, I think his name is Stavanz, Ilan Stavanz, about reviving Hebrew, Eliezer ben Yehuda, and how he did that. I don't know how good a book it is. It's a small book. It's by the same people that came out with the book, if I'm not mistaken, on Hank Greenberg and, these little books about important Jewish figures in modern times. But what did the Safa Brura Society say? Everyone should speak Hebrew. Everywhere, in the street, on the market, not to be embarrassed. Try speaking in Hebrew. They published lists of words, so that this is what it's called. So go to the marketplace and start speaking about this. Was Elias Ben Huda from Chabad family? That is something I will check on for next class, or so maybe one of you can find it as you as we're speaking. Get back to us. I do not know. Achad Ha'am, actually, Achad Ha'am was from a Skvera Chassid background, not from a Chabad background. Salma Shechter was from a Chabad background. I do not know that. I do not know if Eliezer ben Yehuda was from Chabad background. We have a number of early Zalman Shazar is from a Chabad background, but even earlier than him, we have a number. But I don't know if ben Yehuda is from a Chabad background. It's a good question. That's interesting you say that. Have you seen Simcha about a year ago, Hillel Halkin, who also, I believe, was brought up speaking Hebrew, had a memoir in commentary. He's had a couple of memoirs in commentary, and one of them was about his time in camp, it's Camp Masad, and playing baseball, and all the words that they made them use in baseball. That's something significant. I know that, I forget his name, the professor of Hebrew literature at the seminary, Alan Mintz, he's written about Jewish camping, Hebrew-speaking camps, and some of you have been to Camp Masad. These camps obviously don't exist anymore. I think it's a combination of the fact that Hebrew's not important, this old-fashioned Zionism isn't so important, the people who ran Masad all went on Aliyah, and I think most important is that Orthodoxy today is of a different sort, that Camp Masad was not Orthodox in the sense that the camps are today. It's not just Camp Masad, Hador. If you want to see some interesting things, go back to the old Hadoars from the 40s, the 50s. You see maskilim, American maskilim, postmen and blue-collar workers and all different types writing in Hebrew. And then in the 1980s, it becomes American Height or something something like that. It just closes up because you don't have these American Hebraists anymore. And who wants to read Israelis? If you want to read Israelis, you can pick up a Ma'ariv. The whole point was to read this Haskalah Hebrew in America, and all the great scholars, if you went to YU, Samuel Mirsky, Yehuda Mirsky's grandfather was one of the leaders of it. You had people like Yaakov Kabakov. You had people who never went to Israel. Samuel Belkin never stepped foot in Israel, and these were Hebraists. So that's a whole culture that doesn't exist anymore. You have, there's a number of people. You have people at the JTS, old people. You have YU, the old-timers who were these real Hebraists. The guy who wrote, he just passed away, the biography on Hirsch, Noah Rosenblum. There was a whole school of this American Hebraism. Many of these who went to, they went to TI, Teachers Institute, at the seminary, which was Hebrew, and also at Yeshiva College. You had the Teachers Institute. The people who were interested really in learning Gemara, they went to Yeshiva, they went to the Yeshiva. And the others went to the Teachers Institute, where you had people in the Teachers Institute, real Hebraists. Hillel Bavli at the seminary. Great American, probably the greatest American Hebraist poet. Came from Pilvishuk, by the way, or Yechiak of Weinberg's town. Okay, so the EJ says he was from a Chabad family. Very good. Thank you, Chaim. I didn't know about the Masad in there. I just know in New York there was in Pennsylvania there were three Masads, and they slowly closed down. Louis Bernstein did head up one of the Masads, and he was a Hebraist, one of the Hebrew-speaking people. Now the society said that how are they going to spread this? They're going to hire women, teach them basic Hebrew, and then they could teach their children. They also published books, or were planning on publishing books for everyday life. This was the predecessor of what today is the Academy for the Hebrew Language. They came up with all sorts of words, and it wasn't just Hershenson and Elias Ben Yehuda. They brought in various grammarians. You had David Yellen. Today, you have great scholars on, including Professor Sperber, who some of you probably know either his work or certainly you might know him personally. He is a member of, now why is he a member? He's not like the other ones who are experts in Piyut, in poetry, or the Hebrew language. I think because of his great interest, not just in Talmud, but also he's written books on Greek and Latin in Talmud. He's done a lot on development of, let's say, the Aramaic, the terms that they used, how the Hebrew and the Aramaic in the Talmudic period assimilated Greek and Latin words. So obviously, someone like him is perfect for the Society of Hebrew Language because you have to integrate all these American words and French words into the Hebrew language. So who best to turn to than someone who could tell you how they did in Talmudic days? And we all know that some of the words never catch on. How many people call it monit? It's taxi, I think, for most people. And there are many, many words that don't catch on, but many that do catch on. I know that there was a while when machshev or computer, I wasn't sure, but I believe, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that machshev has caught on, and that that's the word for computer. Who else was in this? Well, you also had Rav Yaakov Meir. Rav Yaakov Meir, we'll get back to him. He became the first Rishon LeZion in the modern era. He died in, I think it was 36, if I'm not mistaken, or 37. Rav Uziel took over after him. So here we have these two open-minded Orthodox figures, great Talmid Chachamim, Rav Chaim Herzl and Yaakov Meir, together with people like Ben Yehuda. I mentioned David Yellen. He is actually the son-in-law, for those who know who Pinnis was. What's his name? Eliyahu Pinnis, the brother-in-law. There was an article in the latest Hamayan on him, who's one of the early leaders of the Yishuv. Okay, since I mentioned the children, raising the children, that Chaim Hirschenson was the second Hebrew-speaking family in the world in modern times, let me tell you a little bit about his children. One of his daughters married David de Solapool. Who was David de Solapool? The rabbi of the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue for something like 50 years. I say rabbi, although I asked Mark Angel about this. We don't think he ever received smicha. He was known as reverend and minister. So technically, I don't know if he ever received heter hara. In any event, he was regarded as rabbi. He edited the RCA's Siddur that never became that popular, but that's one of the daughters. Another daughter married someone named Rabbi Morris Lichtenstein. Who was Morris Lichtenstein? Well, he was a Reform rabbi. And together with his wife, Tehila, founded something called the Society of Jewish Science. So what is Jewish Science? Well, I'm sure many of you know what Christian Science is. And now you know what Jewish Science is. By the way, if you look in the Malki Bakodesh, in one or two of the volumes, there's an English introduction by this son-in-law, Morris Lichtenstein, who was a musmach of HUC. Lichtenstein dies in 1938, and Tehila runs the organization until her death in 1973. I believe the other daughter's name, the one who married to Solapool, was Tamar. So these are interesting names. Tamar, Tehila, today we wouldn't look twice at them. But these are not traditional Jewish names in the Orthodox world. You know, you think of Sarah and Rivka and the like. And here, if I'm Hirschen, names a Tehila and a Tamar. I don't think there was any other Tehila or Tamars in the world at that time. So what was this whole science thing they founded? What was in response to Christian Science? I'm sure, as I said, we all know Christian Science. They just believe in prayer, not in medicine. There's been all sorts of court cases about this. Parents who allow their children to die instead of treating them. Most insurance plans actually will pay for a Christian Science practitioner. That's not what Jewish Science was about. They wanted to combine a pro. They didn't give up medicine. It's very hard to be Jewish and abandon medicine. We've had great Jewish doctors, Maimonides and the like. The Talmud tells us specifically that you're not supposed to only rely on God. However, they wanted to combine a treatment of medicine together with prayer, psychology, self-help, something that today would be very popular, I think. And a few years ago, Ellen Umansky, she's a professor, I believe, in Fairfield, Connecticut, at Fairfield University, she published an entire book on this subject called From Christian Science to Jewish Science, Spiritual Healing and American Jews. I've only glanced at the book, but I don't know if she knows who the father of Tehila Lichtenstein was. But in any event, she's known, very well known in her own right. Another daughter was Nina Alderblum. She never married. I mean, she did marry early on, but then I believe either death or divorce, if I'm not mistaken, because she lived... I know she lived for many years not married. She was a student of John Dewey at Columbia. She grew up in New Jersey, as we'll see. She went to Columbia. John Dewey was an important philosopher, an educational reformer. Alderblum at Columbia wrote her doctoral dissertation on the Ralbag, Rav Levi ben Gershom, Gersonides, great medieval Jewish philosopher, scientist. But what's most interesting is this book of hers, which was reprinted... By Jason Aronson about in 1999, right before Aronson went out of business. She died in 1974 and published it many years before. It's called Memoirs of Jewish Memoirs of Childhood, An Approach to Jewish Philosophy, because she tries to throw in also some philosophical ideas. She was part of the Orthodox community, and as far as I know, she was a member in good standing. I know the last years of her life were spent in Israel. She has an essay or two also on one of Jung's volumes, or two of Jung's volumes. Jung wrote a whole series called The Jewish Library. It was first series, second series, third series, with many important volumes, and she has material in that. Incredibly, however, I have to tell you, David Zohar, who has done such a marvelous job analyzing Chaim Hirschman's writings, he was unaware of this book. And he gets Hirschman's date of death wrong. It's really a wonderful book. She talks about life in Constantinople, which I'll explain how they get there and other things. So that's quite interesting. Oh, thank you. By joining the Safa Brewer Society, as I said, you can imagine that Hirschman was not endearing himself to the zealots of Jerusalem. But for the most part, they let him alone in the early years. His father was an important Rav. His father, his brother ran a printing press. But he was getting into trouble. He leaves Jerusalem in 1880 and goes to Germany, where he becomes acquainted and close to a number of the leaders of German Orthodoxy. He becomes close to Israel Hildesheimer, Abraham Berliner, and others. And in 1885, he begins publishing, in Germany, a journal, Hamisterona, which is one of the early rabbinic journals. I mean, Yaakov Ettlinger's journal preceded that, but this is one of the very early ones. And it has contributions from the great scholars of Germany as well as elsewhere. You can get it now on HebrewBooks.org. It also has every issue is full of his own material. Fascinating stuff. Much of it would be later developed in later writings, but incredible stuff. He continues his publication of this journal when he returns to Jerusalem 2 years later. There are articles. This is something which I don't know really anyone knows about. There are articles in there from Micha Yosef Berdyshevsky when he's only 21 years old, when he's still an Orthodox Jew. Berdyshevsky comes from a Hasidic background himself. He wrote early articles. Everyone knows who's written on Berdyshevsky about his articles, let's say on Volozhin and everything. But here you have articles by Berdyshevsky on Agadic themes in a journal, which until they put it on HebrewBooks.org a couple months ago, was almost impossible to get your hands on. And you have, as I said, articles, which I think I have to check the biographies of Berdyshevsky. I had never seen these articles or heard of these articles before, so I think that's quite significant. It's only in the 1890s, by the way, that when Hamisterona is the mid-1880s, but it's in the 1890s when Berdyshevsky's in Berlin that his radical ideology is developed. These might be the earliest articles he ever wrote, the ones in Hamisterona. Hirschman also, as I said, has many articles in there, and we see, although he's a young man here, he's not even 30, he's incredibly learned. Among his most interesting ideas relate to belief and heresy. He's writing about ideas of belief and heresy even in these early years. Why is he writing about these things? Well, because this is an era where many people no longer believe. They refuse to accept the traditional dogmas. Well, Hirschman takes this head on, and he develops this idea based on the Rambam's formulations in the Mishnah Torah that heresy is really not a crime against God, per se. It's not good, but when we speak about heresy being a crime, when we speak about people who are heretics, they're not included in the Jewish community, he says, look at the Rambam's writings carefully. The Rambam always refers to Ha'omer, one who says. One who says the Torah is not from heaven, one who says this, one who says that. Therefore, Hirschman develops the idea that the real issue is the destruction of the communal unity by spreading false ideology. But if you simply have a false idea, if you simply have a heretical idea, and you keep it to yourself, and you don't go around and spread it, you don't say it publicly, Ha'omer means to say it publicly, then you are a Jew in good standing. Whatever your situation is, that's between you and God, but you're a good Jew in good standing, we welcome you into our community, etc., etc. And that heresy is not something we need to be concerned with as long as it's not publicly creating problems. That if you find out, if someone mentions to you, let's say, that he doesn't really believe, don't assume he's a heretic and therefore we can't count to a minion, all these things. He's not regarded as a heretic. This is a private doubt that he has, but that doesn't affect his standing because, as the Rambam says, public heresy is the issue. Well, when you have Hershenson's position like that, first of all, there's no more witch hunts, there's no more heresy hunts, number one. And number two, people who no longer believe. We lose a lot of people in the Orthodox world because they conclude that, I don't believe these dogmas that I'm being told, whatever the dogmas are. And therefore, if I don't believe it, and since I'm going to go to hell anyway, I'm a heretic, I might as well, what's the point of me keeping kosher? What's the point of me doing anything? And Chaim Hershenson, by developing the way he does, he's saying that it doesn't really matter what you believe in. Yes, these are wrong beliefs. We believe that these are improper beliefs, but you're still a Jew. There's still a place for you in our community. Some people tell Lashon Hara. Some people have false beliefs. But it allows people who no longer feel that they can accept the dogma to still remain part of the community, the Torah world. Just don't publicly spread your ideas. If you're a mensch, you realize that in this community, which you want to be in, these ideas are not acceptable, so you keep them to yourself, but you're not a heretic. At least we don't regard you as a heretic. Okay. Don't ask, don't tell. Exactly. That's what he's developing. Now, I think he's actually wrong with the Rambam. I mean, he's right with the Rambam and the Mishnah Torah, but the Mishnah Torah is only dealing with how we relate to him. But if you look in the Mor Nevuchim, and if you look in the Parish of Mishnah, the Rambam's clear that it doesn't matter who you tell. You keep it to yourself. If you have false doctrines, then you have no share in the world to come. But Chaim Hershenson is putting the stress on the Mishnah Torah and the idea that, as communities, we're really not concerned with private heretics. On the one hand, Orthodoxy always speaks about a big tent. And look, on Yom Kippur, right, we say we give permission to pray with the sinners. We welcome everyone in. But traditionalist Orthodoxy is very welcoming to the complete non-believer to be Makari of them. But traditionalist Orthodoxy is not welcoming at all to the Orthodox person who has false beliefs or the Orthodox rabbi whose ideas maybe go a little bit off. They're only welcoming to people who don't know anything and they want to be Makari of them. Chaim Hershenson's point was that as long as you keep your ideas to the self, you're part and parcel of our community. And he repeats this and develops this later on in the Malki Bakodesh, which we'll speak about. And this very point, he publishes a letter from Rav Chaim Sonnenfeld, who at this time was just a Hungarian Talmud Chacham in the land of Israel. He hadn't yet become the leader of the Haredim, the Kanaim, the extreme ones in Israel. And he publishes a letter from Rav Sonnenfeld attacking him. How could you say that? How could you say that heresy has anything to do with public versus private? And he publishes his response as well. Kellner does have the same idea, but I don't think he quotes the Rambam. I think Kellner was speaking in practical terms. Yeah, the Zakin Mamre is a good example. It's a good parallel, but of course the Zakin Mamre does not speak about heresy. It's a different issue. Everyone knows the Zakin Mamre is a great Talmud Chacham. Rav Chaim Hershenson is simply saying that even when it comes to heretical ideas, no different than Mechalei Shabbos, we want you all in our community. Just don't spread it. Don't make trouble. Yes, the tent does get smaller every day. But having said that, next class I will read you something simple that I think you'll find very interesting. One of the things I want to get to from last semester, which I didn't have time today. The same way the tent gets smaller, the fact that that tent is getting smaller, other tents are opening up. I think you'll find very interesting what I read to you. Okay, let's move on. Things get so bad, though. He's back in the land of Israel. Rav Sonnenfeld attacks him. Others attack him. Things get so bad that in 1887, the extremists put a cherem on him, an official cherem. I'm talking about a cherem, an officially proclaimed cherem. I'm sure they blew the shofar and everything else like that. This is nothing new in Jerusalem. Anyone who is somebody got put in cherem in Jerusalem, including many great Talmid Chachamim. But it wasn't his journal. It was his association with Ben Yehuda and other things that got him put in cherem. Now, we have a letter from Israel Hildesheimer, a German letter, in Hildesheimer's collected writings, in which he expresses great anger against the extremists, not just in the land of Israel, but throughout the world, who use the Cheirim to get what they want. And he knew of what he spoke. If you recall my lectures on Hildesheimer, he himself was put under Cheirim, in Cheirim by Ravilla Lichtenstein and others when he was in Hungary. So he knew what it meant to be persecuted by extremists. He describes the great Chil Hashem that these extremists cause. And he cites other rabbis who experienced the attacks of what he calls, quote, the terroristen, the terrorists. And, of course, there's nothing new under the sun. We see it in our own day as well. Hirschenson sees that there's no place for him in the land of Israel. It's just, there really is just an old yeshuv there, and his ideas are not going to be able to flower there. He leaves the land of Israel in 1896 and goes to Istanbul, then known as Constantinople, and becomes principal of two Jewish schools there. And you can read in Adlerbaum's book, her description of this. These were schools in which they taught in Hebrew, Ivrit be'Ivrit. During this time, Hirschenson becomes very interested in education and pedagogy. He even publishes a book on education. He joins the Mizrahi when he's in Turkey, and even he goes to Western Europe as the Mizrahi delegate from Turkey. While there, he's invited to become the rabbi of Hoboken. What happens is you have American Orthodox figures who would go to the, just like they go to the Aguda Convention, they go to the Mizrahi Convention to try to find rabbis, to steal them away. And they found Hirschenson, they were impressed by him, and they invited him to become rabbi of Hoboken. And if you look in his books, it says Hoboken and the environs, the districts around it. I am sitting right now is 1/2 hour from Hoboken. It's amazing that Hoboken today does not have a strong Jewish community, Orthodox community. They have a conservative community because with the rents and the economic situation, you would have thought that Hoboken, which is right over the water from New York City, it's an easy commute. It's full of yuppies. It would be a great place for an Orthodox community. The problem is with us Orthodox is you can't just go there because then there's no minyan. You need to go with a group. Unless you're one of these brave people, it's almost impossible to start a new area. So if you had about, when I lived in New York, there was always people that said, if we can get 10 people to come with us, we'll all together move to Hoboken, and it would be great, but no one wants to be, look, I live, there's a town not far from me where people tried this, and 25 years later, they still hardly have a minion. So no one wants to be the first person in that. But Hoboken used to have a nice Orthodox community. And Chaim Hirschenson, at the end of the 19th century, is invited to come there. He does come there. Let's move on. He remains in Hoboken from, I think he arrives in 1897, if I'm not mistaken, maybe 1898. He remains there until his death in 1935. He becomes a very prolific writer. It refers to him as Rav de Hoboken, Umar Rava, Hare, Jersey City. You know, West Hoboken and it's west, the mountains of Jersey City, Union Hill, the Hasviva. I don't know. I mean, I live in New Jersey my whole life. I don't know of any Union Hill. I think it's probably just an area around Hoboken. Now, what David Zohar did not do, and if I would write a book on Hirschenson, for a long time I planned on writing one until his book came out, I would go back to the old newspapers. I'm sure there's plenty of material in the old Hoboken newspapers about Rav Chaim Hirschenson. As I said, he was very prolific. Look, to be a rabbi in America in those days, you didn't have much to do during the daytime. Maybe you had a funeral or something, but for the most part, if you're a rabbi in Hoboken, after Minyan in the morning and before Minyan at night, you could just sit and learn all day. There wasn't much happening. A woman would bring in a chicken every now and then to ask you about it, but the rabbis in those days were not the social workers they are today. They weren't running the day schools. They weren't visiting people constantly. It was a different type of model. And he is very prolific. And what makes him so significant is... It's not just that that's not what he's prolific. It's not that he's prolific that he's significant. It's what he's saying. We have many prolific writers, as I said. American rabbis, and not just American, European rabbis had plenty of free time. But his writings are radical. Radically new positions in numerous areas. He is, without question, the most original Posek and Orthodox thinker of the 20th century. He's without question the most original post-sig of the 20th century. I think he's probably also the most original Orthodox thinker of the 20th century. If not the most original, perhaps the most radical Orthodox thinker. And let me explain why. I'm not talking about an individual who comes up with some crazy idea. I'm talking about someone who has a whole coherent system put together in which everything he does is new, is original, is unique, it's radical. That's what I mean when I say someone as a thinker. He's certainly not the most significant thinker and not the most significant post-sig. The fact that many of you have never heard of him till this class shows that. However, he is the most original. Now, this, as I said, this is unusual to be original in both thought and halakha. Rav Kook, we all know that Rav Kook was incredibly original in his philosophical writings. Those of you who saw my Svarim blog post, the last one I put up, I quoted a couple of very original things from Rav Kook. It just came out in 2008. However, in halakha, Rav Kook was anything but original. He was pretty mainstream, conservative, with a small c. But Chaim Hirschstein, everything he touched became radically different when he was through with it. There are some people who everything they touch just comes out differently. They have a completely radical way of looking at it. When I think in terms of halakha, in a few classes we've spoken about the former post-sake of Lakewood, Rav Avadi. He's one of those people. For some reason, everything he looks at just comes out differently than everything everyone else, the way everyone else looks at. You have post-sakim who just have strange or unusual ways of looking at things. Idiosyncratic. And that is Chaim Hirschstein. He's also someone whose vision is incredible in that he uses his learning, which is also immense, to put it in the service of a vision full of original ideas, a vision of modern halakha, a vision of what it means to be a Torah Jew in modern times, and what the practical implications of this are. We have any number of thinkers who speak about being a Torah Jew in modern times. Look, the Torah Mada, modern Orthodox world, is full of these people. However, it's never really put into practice. It's all in theory and thought. I even say that about someone like Rav Lichtenstein. He has so many beautiful essays in which he raises these ideas, and he always says things like, he raises questions. Perhaps this could be a possibility, but he never actually puts his foot down and says anything about this. In terms of Jewish law, the modern Orthodox have seen this completely. They're very big into the thinking aspects, the thought, ideology. But look at practical halakha. Other than Rabbi Jachter's works, have any modern Orthodox types written any Jewish law? They've ceded it entirely to the Haredim. Hirschstein is very different. He's willing to grab the bull by both horns. A modern Orthodox approach to Jewish law and a modern Orthodox approach to Jewish thought. And the term modern Orthodox didn't even exist, but that's certainly what he's doing. One of the big issues he deals with, you know it's a big issue because otherwise it wouldn't be the title of Schweid's book, is democracy and halakha. Democracy in his time was very important. We all take it for granted. However, democracy in the late 19th, early 20th century was not taken for granted. It was taken for granted, I think, for men. However, it wasn't taken for granted for women, obviously. Blacks didn't have democratic rights. Much of the world was not democratic at this time. So there was a lot of discussion in the early part of the 20th century about suffrage, the right to vote, what system of government is the best. Just think of the early 20th century. You still had monarchies. You still had the czar. You had semi-monarchies. You had all sorts of systems. And there was a lot of talk and discussion in the air about democracy, also about religion. Separation of religion and state, and how much should religion be involved in the government? What does it mean to be democratic? So it's not accidental that Hirschstein also looks towards that. From the Jewish side, there's immediate issues. Judaism has many great ideas. We can take credit for many things. We cannot take credit for democracy. For that, you have to look to Athens. You have to look to Greece. There is a democratic system to a certain extent in the Jewish community. We have elections. There's something called the Zion Tov Ha'ir, but I wouldn't exactly call it democratic. Not to say that Athens was completely democratic either, obviously not, but it really wasn't democratic. There was the poor people really didn't have any say in these things. The rich people were controlling. Poor people actually couldn't even vote in Jewish communities. But we have a system of democracy, no question about it, but only local, not national. If you ask a typical person who's been to yeshiva, they'll tell you that the Jewish system is monarchy. That we will have a king. We once had a king. We will have a king in the future. If we had a real Jewish society today, we'd have a king. You even have figures. Rav Shach in his letters speaks out, polemicizes democracy. Democracy, such a terrible thing. He never explains what he wants in its place. I'm assuming he wants a Torah dictatorship, where the Gedolim have a dictatorship. I don't know. But he writes against democracy, because when you think of it, democracy has real problems. A democracy allows everyone to have a say, and at least in the classical Jewish perspective, certain people shouldn't have says. And I'm not just referring to the heretics. Now, the sacred texts of Judaism were formed, and I'm talking about the Talmud, even the biblical period, in an era when monarchy was the form of government. And if you look at the Messianic era, if you look at hopes for the Messianic era, everyone speaks about Melech HaMashiach, the return of the King Messiah, which makes perfect sense. Because writing in an era when the form of government was monarchy, you would obviously write about the future era, the utopian era, the era of everlasting peace as one led by a monarch. I don't think there's any question that if these ideas were developed in an era which was not a monarchy, then you wouldn't have this conception of a Melech HaMashiach. Theocracy? No. Judaism's never been a theocracy. Never. With the exception of maybe a short period in Second Temple periods when the high priests ruled. Jewish people were always ruled by kings and judges. We've never had a theocracy. It could be that if the Gedolim ever take charge, then we'll have a theocracy, but that's no different than the Islamic world. Do you know that the Iranian Revolution was the first example of a theocracy coming to power in Islamic history? Until the mullahs took over in Iran, you never had a theocracy in Iran. Then you had it, of course, in Afghanistan. So both Judaism and Islam do not know a theocracy. The term theocracy, incidentally, is coined by Josephus, but he means something else. He means the fact that that the Torah is our constitution, but the classically theocracy means rule by religious leaders. Now, Rabbi Yisrael, you mentioned the Ron, who has allowance for a non-theocratic government. I don't remember that in the Ron. The classic example, and that was on the speaker right now, is the Abarbanel. I don't recall the Ron if he speaks against monarchy, but the Abarbanel had lived under a monarchy. He lived under a terrible monarchy at the end of Spain. And then he goes to Portugal. So he had no faith in monarchy, and he writes about how the Republican form of government, Republican with a small r, that he saw when he went to Italy, that that's the best form of government. And he develops the idea, which is then followed by others, including another, not just mostly Achronim, but there's a couple other Rishonim, if I'm not mistaken, that the whole idea of a monarchy, of a kingship, is optional. And if you look in the Chumash, that's the pshat in the Chumash. It says, you look in Shmuel, that if the people want a king, they can have it. But if they don't want a king, they don't need to have a king. That seems to be the simple pshat. And many people have developed this, including Rav Chaim Hirschenson. In fact, I see we're already coming to the end. Next class, we'll begin speaking about how Rav Chaim Hirschenson tries to make Torah Judaism coexist with democracy. And it's not just American democracy. In fact, it's not even American democracy fundamentally. He's writing the works that will... He knows there will be a future Jewish state. How should the Jewish state be run? How can you have democracy and still have a Torah society? And then we will move on to the other aspects. Democracy means freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, no persecution on account of religious beliefs. Well, doesn't traditional Judaism believe in persecuting the non-believers? And we will see how Rav Chaim Hirschenson makes sense of what it means in modern times to be a non-believer, to be a non-Shomer Shabbos Jew, and how he sees the future of the Jewish people, how to create, basically, his point was that we can either have halacha the way it's been practiced for all these years, or we can build a halacha that will work with a Taras Chaim, that will work with a new Jewish state. We need to have a government. The same things that Rav Herzog spoke about that we dealt with. How do you have a court system in accordance with Torah? How do you have non-Jews obviously we have to count non-Jews as part of our society. Well, what do we do with them? And it's all the things that the Rambam doesn't deal with because it didn't exist in his society. And that you can't really find clear answers in the Talmud, but we need to extrapolate. That's what we'll get to next class, and we'll come back to certain theological things, but I think you will all find Rav Chaim Hirschenson very fascinating. So before we go, any comments or questions? Now's the time for those who are new. We usually leave 15 minutes or so for comments. Ah, there you go. What the computer can teach, what the Internet can tell us. Union, they formed Union City. Okay, there you go. I didn't know that. Union City is right over the right through the Lincoln Tunnel. Union City is right now, well, not just right now, for the last 20 or 30 years, the Kloisenberger Rebbe. There's a few Kloisenberger Rebbes. There's one in Israel, too. But the Kloisenberger Rebbe in America is centered in Union City. He moved out of Brooklyn some 30 years ago, and they set up in Union City. And if you want to go see the Kloisenberger, that's where it is. Yes, we will get to his response to biblical criticism. That's just one of the many things he deals with. He's the only posek who raised the question, is biblical criticism mutter or usser? Or maybe it's mutter, but maybe it's forbidden. Parts of it, but not others. And he writes a whole long tshuva about biblical criticism. We will get to that next class. Seder HaMikra is a different book. I'm talking in the Malki Bakodesh. He deals with, Seder HaMikra deals with chronology, issues of chronology. And in fact, that, it was that book that was attacked in the Yiddish pamphlet that he responded to. But he responds to the question of biblical criticism in the Malki Bakodesh. The first person to call attention to the Malki Bakodesh and biblical criticism is, believe it or not, Louis Jacobs in his book, We Have Reason to Believe, published in the 50s. His chapter on biblical criticism, he's the first one to call attention to it. I did not know that, Chaim Landerer. For those who know, Chaim Landerer is a great bibliophile, and I did not know that it was dedicated to... But I'll tell you something, maybe you don't know Chaim Landerer. He has another book, which I'll tell you offline, which no one knows about. I've been able to identify one copy in America. David Zohar doesn't know about it either, and it's a response to, apparently it's a response to certain criticisms. They have it in the rare book room of the seminary, and it's not even listed under his name because it's a commentary on another work. So it took me many years before I was able to find this book. And it's Malki Bakodesh is available online. Not only is it available online, the author, the guy who runs Hebrew Books, he wasn't sure how to spell Hirschenson, so you have it, Hirschenson spelled two different ways online, so you have double. I'll tell you something else that's online. First of all, his parish on Chumash, Nimukei Chumash, which is great, his parish on Rashi. But the best thing is, he has three volumes, commentary on Maseches Horayot. The second volume is on the Yerushalmi Horayot, which is in itself is very interesting. The Sri Deish quotes it, incidentally. In that book, Rav Chaim Hirschenson develops the idea, follows from the Tosfos Yom Tov, that you can interpret the Talmud, the Mishnah different than the Talmud. But in the third volume of the Parish on Horayot, he has letters in which he responds to the various critics and letters between him and other Gedolim. Most people don't know about that. They know about the letters, the numerous letters in Malki Bakodesh, including a letter from Rabbi Guterman of Scranton. But they don't know about his fascinating letters in the third volume of the Parish on Horayot. HebrewBooks.org. It's a super commentary on Rashi. But as everything else with Hirschenson, he goes off on all sorts of tangents and there's all sorts of interesting stuff. Just plug his name in. There's two ways. Just plug in Malki Bakodesh and then you'll get the name spelling. And plug in that and you'll see. It's called Nimuke Rashi or Nimuke Chumash or something like that. I believe there's only two volumes on Bereishis and Shmos. Of course he spoke English. He was in America for some 37 years. All the old-time rabbis spoke English, the ones who came over, the Litvisha. He didn't write anything in English, though, and I can't say that he could write English very well, because he had his son-in-law do the introduction to the book, but he certainly knew Yiddish. He quotes things that appear in the English newspapers. One of his best stuff, by the way, in the Parish on Horayot, you won't know it, because you have to go through it, just smack in the middle of the commentary. This just hit my right now. I wasn't even planning on saying that. But Horayot has the sugya about, who goes first if you have to save people, the woman or the man, who do you save first, the woman or the man, etc. He has a whole discussion there about the Titanic episode. because the Titanic happened right around then. And he speaks about, you know, how in the Titanic it was ladies first and how that's against Jewish law, that that's not, we don't distinguish it that way. But then he says, however, if you want to do a Kiddush Hashem, like the person, Levi Strauss, right, who were one of the Strausses, he's represented in the movie Titanic. He's the guy with his little man standing near him and just is having his tea as the water's filling up. He refused, and this was famous, he gave up his seat because he was one of the rich people. You all remember from the movie, he's one of the rich people that could have gone on the lifeboats. He gave it up for others. So Hershenson said that to make a Kiddush Hashem like he did, then you are permitted to give up your seat and sacrifice yourself for someone else. But the Victorian idea of ladies first, he shows how that's not a Torah idea. But of course, he's not very happy with the idea that men should go first because, you know, that which the Gemara says they have more holiness. He reinterprets that also. So there's all sorts of interesting stuff there. But unless you pull it all together, like this book I mentioned to you, who would ever know that there's a discussion of the Titanic? As far as I know, the only halachic discussion of the Titanic in Jewish literature. It's Abraham Strauss. I don't know. You have to see. You plug in Wikipedia, you'll see that I think it's Strauss, one of the leading Jewish philanthropists and entrepreneurs, was one of the people on the Titanic. Did he have students? Other than his sons-in-law, he didn't. He didn't teach in a yeshiva. He was a rav in a community. Most of the children of his Balabatim, of course, grew up non-religious. In those days, if you had 10% who grew up Shomer Shabbos of the young generation, you're lucky. He was the owner of Macy's. I don't know. It's very easy if we'll get it for next class unless someone's plugging it in. And as I said, in the movie, the guy has a nice part in it. I dropped my pen here, but I'll check on that for next class. Okay. Unless anyone has any further questions or comments, we will pick up. Did he correspond with? I don't know who you're asking, but he corresponded with everyone. Yaakov Yosef had passed away just a couple of years after he came. But all the other rabbis, if you're interested in the history of American Orthodoxy, he has all these American rabbis who really are insignificant figures historically, but they're interesting rabbis. He corresponds with the Rav of Utica, New York, no one's ever heard of him, but you see a nice Talmud Chacham and Amdan in Utica. He has a heated correspondence with Rav Elezer Meir Prell, who was the Rav of Elizabeth, the father-in-law of Rabbi Teitz, on, among all issues, did the Yerushalmi see the Bavli? They had this whole debate there. Did the Yerushalmi see the Bavli? You can see in the Malki Bakodesh, he has this, and in the Parashat Harayot, correspondence with Baruch Epstein, the Torah Tamima. And if you remember my Sfarim blog, I think that the Baruch Epstein, this whole story about the Mayan Ganim and all the Mayan Ganim, this book, how you know that this is a book that describes how women could study Torah if they want to. Who is this person, Archivolti? How does Baruch Epstein know that he was also quoted in these rare Italian Sfarim? He signed the psak dealing with the famous dispute in Mikvah and Rovigo and all this. Baruch Epstein's a bibliophile, but how does he know this stuff? He knows it because Chaim Hershenson, in his letter, published in Malki Bakodesh, gives him all this information, and then Baruch Epstein goes and publishes his Torah Tamim and publishes his Makar Baruch, and he cribs from all the information he got from Chaim Hershenson and puts it in there. It's all part of Baruch Epstein, this whole story he invents about Reina Batya, I talked about it in the blog. By correspondence with Ritzi Pesach Frank, I will talk about this when we deal with Ritzi Pesach. The most significant letter Ritzi Pesach Frank ever wrote dealing with mandatory Palestine, Ritzi Pesach didn't print it, for reasons you'll see. He only printed the first half, Halachic half. Chaim Hershenson printed it. He's related somehow to Ritzi Pesach, because he calls him, you know, he has the Shin Bet, you know, which is the Shar Bisri, you know, somehow they're connected through marriage somehow. But numerous Gedolim, Rabin Sion Uziel, as I said, just look in the introduction, also Attack, he publishes the attacks against him. Rav Mintzberg, Yisrael Zev Mintzberg, who was one of the Haredi Rabbonim in the land of Israel, writes to him attacking him, and Chaim Hershenson writes back, has to do with Chaim Hershenson's view of women's suffrage that we'll speak about. Chaim Hershenson writes back saying that people like you, the woman, her only purpose in life is basically to cook and to feed you. You basically have prevented them from being anything, even from being a woman. So we will get into all this next class. Okay, well, good night, everyone, and we'll see you all next week.
Good night, thank you. Good night,
thank
everybody.
You.
We hope you found this recording a most enjoyable learning experience. We welcome your feedback. Please contact us at info@torahinmotion.org or at www.torahinmotion.org. Have a great day. Thank you.